Greetings from Govinda Garden on the bank of the Kaveri. I'm visiting my godbrother at his ashram, His Holiness Bhakti Gaurava Nrisingha Maharaj, a very, very old friend of mine from Vrindavan. And very beautiful ashram. I should just give some explanation, too, about today's class. This is a little bit out of the way. I mean, I don't think there's anything. It's in the middle of nowhere. Not nowhere. I mean, 3 or 4 kilometers, there's a town. So getting cell phone reception, I had to kind of walk around the ashram and find a place where I had a few bars. And the other thing is, somehow this cell phone I have in India, it doesn't charge very well. So from two standpoints, there's a chance that we may lose reception. One, from the standpoint of, you know, not just having a good reception. The second thing is from the phone running out, even though I fully charged it just before the class, it's already just down. In that case, I'll try in my room, and although I don't get any bars there, somehow I get some reception. So before I begin, so it may end a little early. Well, if it goes out, it means the bars went out. They can come back on in a few minutes. First, some soul there can please tell me that you can hear me clearly.
Yes, Maharaj, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you very much. beautiful, beautiful ashram. You know, Vrindavan is a very beautiful place. It takes a little bit to enter it internally to actually extract the beauty of it. But this is physically manifest in the south. It's about 10 yards from me, maybe about 20 yards from me on the back of the ashram is the Kaveri. And, you know, the moon appears to be a little bit polluted. This is crystal clear, flowing deeply, beautiful islands in the middle of the Kaveri, sometimes with little temples in those islands. And, you know, the ashram itself, you know, with the coconut trees, that they even got one seed from Haridas Thakur Samadhi and planted it here, so they have a suitable, cool, beautiful banyan tree. And beautiful, interesting temple complex. I'm going to try to put some pictures and send them out, but they have a beautiful Shiva Lingam when you come in. And when you come in, there's a Kerala temple, and that's beautiful. It's like a round temple with a thatched roof. They have beautiful Radha Madhava and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then because it's the south, you don't have to have the temple inside, so then they have a little space, and then they have the Kirtan Hall, and then they're all beautifully hand-painted with designs on the floor. I mean, it's very beautiful. And then you go behind, there's a whole temple complex. It's just like when we go to Srivasangam, and they have those little temples for Advaitacharya and Gadadhar. We have another little temple with a huge Jagannath, probably the size of the Jagannath in Puri with Gurgadadha. And then they have another little temple, and it's all very finely done of Nrisingadev that they had carved here. And then another little temple, which is Prabhupada's Samadhi. So it's very, very beautiful. And one really nice thing also is there are children of devotees. Maybe they came here when they were 10 or 11, and now they're 19, 20, etc., who are full devotees. I mean, you know, they could get married or not, but even if they get married, the temple is supported by businesses that were started. which provide sufficient income to maintain the ashram and to provide a future if anybody in the future gets married and wants to work. I mean, these are substantial businesses that they're developing. There's one water factory, so that they, with a, you know, an international stance, so they're bottling water, and they have other businesses. And so that's really nice to see, and how nicely and positively they're engaged in Krishna consciousness. And at the same time, because you have to compete with the material world in one sense, Mars does some real exciting things with the young devotees. They're going to go camping in an island in the Indian Ocean on Nicobar Islands, and they'll go camping for 10 days. So the children get it. Not, they're not children anymore, but it's nice to see that they grew up in Krishna consciousness. And very, very simple, protected atmosphere. Very, very Krishna conscious. So I'm kind of... If you've seen in Chaitanya Gaudiya Math, where we visit that, where they have the Vrindavan section and they have a Govardhan Hill, they also built a Govardhan Hill, you know, and on top of the Govardhan Hill, it's small, maybe it's about 20 yards or something, you know, across, you know, but they've got it boulders here, but it's very nicely done, painted with bonsai trees, and, you know, and on the top, I go when I was a little temple where Giriraj is there. I kind of had inspiration. I don't know if it'll manifest. I have to do that someplace in the West. I'm a little Govardhan Hill. Because Giriraj is so merciful. I am in separation. So I went back there for a week to Govardhan to associate with His Holiness the Ranjan Swami and His Holiness Parthasarathy Goswami. And that was also nice. So, okay, I still have a bar here, so we're going good. So in this Brihad Bhagavatam, then, it's this very, very wonderful book because it presents bhakti, and what we want is bhakti. Because unless you get bhakti, you can never be satisfied in heart. And bhakti is the essence of devotion or love. It's the essence of the Lord's pleasure potency. And in perfection, that is the nature of our consciousness. Sri Krishna Bhakti, you hear the birds? Sri Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavata. We may also be, I may also have to move, because I got a feeling they'll also have their arkeep here. Sri Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavato Mati. That's the nature of the pure soul. When you become pure, devotion manifests from your heart. And the way to get bhakti sanjayate bhakti, is you have to practice bhakti to get bhakti. And to practice bhakti, you have to have faith in bhakti, and therefore you have to hear about bhakti. And you have to be inspired by bhakti. And where is bhakti? Bhakti is in the hearts of the devotees. So studying this book is so important for our spiritual life, because we understand what is bhakti. And we understand it in two ways, because we see perfection manifest in different circumstances. When you want to understand any concept deeply and really realize that concept, have a very clear understanding of that concept, it's very, very healthy intellectually and spiritually to see that concept in different contexts. Because then it tests if you actually understand what that concept is. If you see a concept in different forms or shape, then you have to understand the essence of that concept. One time in 1982, I was visiting Mayapur in December, and one of my godbrothers said, "Would you like to meet Prabhupada's godbrother, His Holiness Bhakti Rakshaka Sridhar Maharaj?" And I said, "Sure, yeah, let me meet him." And I went to Navadvip, and he was sitting there practically alone on his veranda on the second floor. They call that first floor in India. And he said, they introduced him that this was the principal of the Gurukul. Then he looked at me and he said, "How is Pradyumna?" Because our godbrother Pradyumna won the hearts of so many nice Vaishnavas, because he's a cultured person and he used to
in service for Prabhupada, stay with the different god brothers of his and learn Shastra and discuss the philosophy. And then he said, oh, Gurukul, Maharaj said, Srila Sridhar said, the ancient system of Indian education, and he was a tremendous intellectual and a tremendous devotional scholar and devotee, and he took that concept and he just, you know, brought it into different periods of time, in different shastras, in different ways in which it was practiced, and it went on for about an hour, and it was so satisfying. That type of stuff, because it was in different contexts. And I really, in a short time, I was getting so much enlightenment on that one concept. You hear the nice birds? It's like a tropical forest. It's like Vrindavan, the cuckoos sing in five different types of tunes, so that probably is a cuckoo. And so in different contexts, and then he, after that, he said, take prasadam. And then he said, prasadam, the, you know, spiritual food stuff, and he did the same thing. So I was thinking, Vriya Bhagavatamrita is like that. We see the concept of bhakti practiced in different circumstances with different flavors of love and different depths of intimacy of love. So you study this book, you learn what is bhakti, you become attracted to bhakti. And at the same time, you can discriminate different levels of bhakti. Because ultimately, it presents bhakti in a progressive way up to the highest, which is braja bhakti, which is ultimately the love of the gopis, the mood of the gopis. So it's also giving us aspiration, although we're so fallen. But being fallen, patita pavana hetu pava avata, Sri Krishna Chaitanya pavu, loya kora more, patita pavana hetu pava. But this incarnation of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is patita pavana. He purifies the most fallen. That is us. And he's giving us that devotion, that highest devotion. But to aspire for it, you must clearly know what it is. You must know the essence of devotion, and you must know the gradations of devotion. So this is very, very wonderful. We've just seen this king. We saw the Brahmin, who's devotional, and his domain is his family. Now we see the king. His domain is the kingdom. And we see Varakya, we see detachment to the level of indifference. Because he's in the midst of so much wealth. How wonderful to see devotion in the realm of temptation. Not that you put yourself in the realm of temptation, but you are in the realm of temptation because you're in the material world. But it's nice to see someone who is a grihastha, who is Krishna conscious. So nice to see that. In the realm of temptation, in the realm of surrounded by material facility, how nice, what to speak of a king. And he's so detached that he establishes a main deity in the kingdom, and people from all over the world are coming and taking shelter and getting nice prasadam and being welcomed. Vaishnavas should be open-hearted, especially a sadhu and a leader. They should be open. You should always feel welcome in their presence, and therefore you should always feel their affection in their heart to help you. Okay, I'm going to do something now I have to do. I see that my cell phone is running out, unfortunately, and therefore I'm going to have to shift and hope in that shift back to my room to plug this in. We don't use it. If I do, then on Sunday
After this, I'm going with Maharaj, Sringa Maharaj, and we're going to drive from here. This is near Mayapur, not Mysore. I'm going to drive to, but the problem is my phone, I have good reception there. The problem is my phone, I don't know, this Indian phone only charges for half hour.
It's quite a battery.
Yeah.
They don't have a system where when it fully charges, shuts off.
Yeah.
I have my whole battery.
Yeah.
Pushed out the
okay. Okay, well, I'm going to go back. I'll still get reception, I think. I think I'll be okay. And it's not. You can all still hear me? Did someone say you can hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Lousy. What? Yeah. It is. So, and I'm going. Maharaj has another ashram on the bank of the ocean. And I'll be headed there, which is a 7-hour ride, but he has a SUV. So we will see, I'll see the countryside, but I'm not much of a tourist. I'd rather just stay in my room. Okay, I'm going back to my little room here. So let me just plug it in and set myself up for the class. And I lost my train of thought, but hopefully, let me turn on the light. Okay. How are we doing? I'm plugged in. You can still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. If someone's brave enough, if the thing goes down, Wait. Okay, I gotta plug in the. Okay. One second, I'm sorry. And the class will definitely have to end on time because there's a Ranganath temple near here that it's only 3 kilometers that I want me to see. Okay, well, let's just hope for the best. It definitely could go out. So I was describing this king and his wonderful level of devotion. And he has his whole kingdom, but he establishes deities, puts the land from his heart. Because this is Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness means that God is the center. Prabhupada taught us this. And it's from the heart. You actually feel that Krishna owns everything, and therefore you see everything as Krishna's. And when you see everything as Krishna's, you're seeing reality, and you're thrilled at every moment. The whole purpose of karma yoga is to take the fruit of consciousness, where to enjoy. You want to see things as separate from Krishna so you can possess them and exploit them, and to offer them to Krishna. And by offering them to Krishna, you'll see them as Krishna's. This is the real purpose of the deity. It's not just a decoration in the heart. The deity is to create that consciousness. That's why some puja or worship is necessary. That's why archana is necessary, although the holy name is sufficient in itself for purification. To purify the mind and purify the senses, you also need some archana or some worship. To develop that consciousness. So we saw the king, and by his prosperity, because he is using everything for Krishna, Krishna provides. This is spiritual economics, which takes a great deal of faith. Krishna will provide what you need. And if you're a king and a leader, and you use the kingdom for Krishna, and you have that consciousness, this king, he put deities, and not only for deities, but he put the pujaris and the brahmins who took care of the deities as the legal caretakers of the land. And then there was reciprocation and piety, anad bhavanti bhutani parjanyan anasambhava. All living beings subsist on food grains, and food grains come from rain, and rain comes from sacrifice. Therefore, the all-pervading transcendence is there in acts of sacrifice. The food grains come, rain comes from sacrifice. So that mood creates prosperity. And of course, there's individual karma, but a simple person, he may live very, very simply. But Krishna will take care, because that's what he needs for his spiritual life. Anyway, and it attracts sadhus, and therefore people are not just coming to see the deities, they're coming to see the sadhus. And he himself, because he doesn't have that ahankara, that I am the controller, I mentioned this, with Lord Brahma, we see when he's about to create, he says, if I create, what is that going to do for my consciousness? If I create the whole world, that's going to create the illusion that I am the controller. So so what did he do? He heard the Bhagavatam, which infuses the consciousness with devotion. So that when you approach the objects of the senses, you tend to approach them love and devotion for the pleasure of Krishna. Even when you take prasadam, you take the nice taste, but you're meditating, Krishna has enjoyed this. So he does humble service. He doesn't ask anybody to do something that he won't do himself. So people see him in the temple cleaning the floor. It's so wonderful to see devotion in the midst of such power and not get carried away, because even Lord Brahma, you know, he got carried away. Brahma Vimohan Lila at that position. And then what did he want? He wanted to be born in a low family, Haridas Thakur, so he wouldn't become overwhelmed with the material situation. And then when Narada visits that kingdom, you know, usually when someone explains something, there's a little exaggeration from the story. But this kingdom is so wonderful, and Narada Muni sees it, he sees that it's even better. And now this wonderful verse is the king, when Narada Muni says to the king, you are the topmost devotee, he immediately worships Narada. He can become, I'm the topmost devotee, therefore you should serve and worship me. Immediately, now listen to this phrase, and if we can just inculcate this one phrase today, I think our life becomes perfect. His head bowed down in embarrassment by the weight of hearing his own praise. The head bowed down in embarrassment by hearing the weight of his own praise. Isn't that the weight of praise? Embarrassment by the weight of his own praise. And this is just, think of faith. It's a nice verse in the Bhagavatam. This is from Bhakti Sambhava. I'm studying it. And it's a section of Rag Marg. So to explain Rag Marg, he goes to the seventh canto. At the beginning of the seventh canto, there's the story of Sishupala and the Rajasuya Yajna, where Sishupala is so envious of Krishna that when Krishna is made the head person in the assembly of all the kings, which was a shock. I explained this before. When kings came to the Rajasuya Yajna, every king got a Raj Abhishek. They actually performed full Abhishek to all the kings. Can everybody hear me?
Can everybody hear me?
Yes, Maharaj.
Okay, I feel that, and it's affecting. So when he came, there was a question of how someone who is so hateful of Krishna can, because when Krishna killed him, everyone saw that his soul came into the air and entered into the heart of Krishna. So people were shocked, and Yudhisthira was shocked. How can such a person attain perfection, even though he's hateful of Krishna? So when Narada Muni begins to explain this, he explains, well, the criticism of Krishna, how do you think that this affects Krishna? Why do you think he's disqualified because he criticized Krishna? Is it because the criticism is sinful, or do you think the criticism caused Krishna pain? And it's a very beautiful thing, and it analyzes this Sushupal. It's a very interesting thing. But one thing Narada Muni tells King King, he first explains that the criticism cannot pain Krishna, because criticism is in relationship with the body, and Krishna is not a material body. So if you're not identifying with the material body, then these things don't affect you. And then he gives a very beautiful verse, and it explains four things you go through when you identify with the body. So he says, O King, the material body, which is meant to experience the nature of criticism, praise, honor, and desire and dishonor, is created due to an inability to discriminate between matter and spirit. So you experience these things, criticism, praise, honor, and dishonor, when you identify with the body. And one who doesn't identify with the body doesn't experience these things. So I'm just thinking myself that this phrase, bowed down in embarrassment by the weight of hearing his own praise. And I have to say very frankly, I was trying to realize it because I like to hear my own praise. And I was trying to, I'm on the bottom of the platform, I was just embarrassed when I read this verse. I was trying to think of an incident and understand it even philosophically, how praise is an embarrassment, and how praise is a burden. And I just thought of one example which helped me understand this point. That, you know, I know a few verses, I read a few books, and then sometimes people say, oh, you're a good scholar. And I actually say, when people say that to me, I feel very embarrassed. Why? Because I live in India, and I know what a good scholar is. And I just saw even one of my former students, I told you, I sometimes call him up. If I call him up and ask a verse in the Bhagavatam, he becomes almost like a channeler for a higher power of knowledge. And he'll start with logic and reason and realization. He'll reel off four or five commentaries on every verse. I'm sure it's not that he studies so much. He has proven some scar. He has previous impressions to Jnana knowledge. I cannot duplicate in this life. There are people like this. So I feel embarrassed. You call me a scholar? I know what a scholar is. So this is the thing. When you know the absolute standard, when you're praised by someone, when you're praised by someone who projects you to the absolute standard, when you know your standard in relationship or relative to the absolute standard, it's embarrassing. So when you tell someone he's a devotee or he has qualities, who is a devotee, and that person is focusing on Krishna and focusing on the devotees of Krishna, and actually understanding what the standard of God is in terms of power, opulence, and control, and what the standard of his devotee is in terms of his heart and devotion, he feels embarrassed. Because he sees his praise in a relative way.
not an absolute way. When you're on the platform of Ahankara and developing the concept, I am the controller, I am the enjoyer, and you get praised, you take it seriously. When you're on the platform of bhakti and devotion and you're focused on the Supreme Lord, when you hear praise, you relativize that praise in context of the absolute. And you actually feel embarrassed on that platform. I'm going to read a previous purport of the Brahmin where he's praised. And then he says, who am I, the most wretched person? How much charity am I able to give? What opulence do I have? And how have I ever reciprocated with the Lord in devotional service? But here's the commentary, very short. Listen carefully. Any true devotee of Krishna considers himself insignificant, thinking himself one of countless jivas who are mere sparks of God's splendor. The devotee is sorry for having foolishly rebelled against his creator. And reflecting on this rebellion, he thinks that his relative influence among other jivas means little. So if you have tattva jnan, if you have actually knowledge of God, then the influence and powers that you have are relatively little. So a Krishna-conscious person, if he's praised, what to speak, he's not identifying with the body, and he realizes that a lot of the material qualities he have are in relationship with his karma and body, not in relationship necessarily with the soul. Now, you can be a great athlete in one life, and the next life you can be spastic. You can be an athlete in this life, and when you get older, you can be debilitated and crippled. Even when Prabhupada would see his devotees chanting and dancing, the young devotees, Prabhupada said, where is my jumping body now? I once heard, I think it was from Hari Kesh, that Prabhupada used to play soccer, and he was a goalie or something, but anyway. So this is the mood of a Vaishnava. And he's realized from the heart he's so much focused on God and God's glories, and he so much sees the world according to the desires of Krishna and the devotees, not according to his own desires, because he's in love. And when you're in love, you see the world according to the desires of another. And that's so satisfying in your heart, because that's the pure heart, and that's the nature of the soul. It's so nice to see this king. And then, of course, just to make that distinction, there's a difference between this humility and a lack of self-esteem. Because although they look the same externally, when one is humble, he gives value or worth to his position as servant of God. It's not that he doesn't like that position, or he thinks there's anything wrong with that position. The position of servant of God is the thing that he values. So if I have discussions with people, it's not that he feels worthless in the core of his heart. He may feel, some insignificance in terms of the material position, but in terms of the spiritual position, he's aspiring for dasa, dasa, anu dasa. So psychologically, what he is and what he wants, in one sense, there's some congruence, although he always feels, in one sense, I'm not a devotee, but from the heart, he's feeling devotion and he's feeling love. So that position is actually satisfying. And it's healthy. It's healthy psychologically. Where lack of self-esteem means you don't have a value system for being so-called insignificant or so-called in the humble position. So you want to be the controller. So it's something different. I can't go into the whole class in that. So now just a little bit that, so what's going to happen now, and I'm probably going to stop early too because I'll leave time for questions and I have to go. But the king himself is going to point to the next level of devotion and the next position. And that's the next chapter. This is Boma on the earth. So on the earth, we see the devotion of the Brahmin the family man and the king, the ruler. And he's going to point to the next chapter, Gibeon, which is the demigods. And the king is going to describe the demigods in both a superior material and spiritual position. And he's going to describe them in their material and subtle position. It's more rarefied, and therefore it has more access to direct association from the Supreme Lord. The Brahmin and the king have deities, but the demigods actually have a rarefied position where they can associate directly with the Supreme Lord. So it's a higher, and they're effulgent bodies, and they're worshipped by everyone, and by nature sinless, they're fixed in goodness, they're free from distress, they're always happy, they can grant blessings, there's no disease, there's no... one sadhu once told me, you know, he pointed to his stomach, and in Hindi he said, date nahi tike. If the stomach is not good, sir nahi tike. The head is not good. So much of our practices of spiritual life are dependent on the vehicle which we find ourselves in. And I spoke to one sadhaka in Vrindavan, because I'm interviewing sadhakas in Vrindavan for a new book I'm writing. And I want their realizations on chanting. And the sadhakas I'm interviewing are exclusively in line from Prabhupada. But I interviewed one sadhaka who's a very, very serious sadhaka. He just dedicates his life to sadhana. And he's married. And he described that his spiritual life, in terms of his focus and chanting, really took off when him and his wife decided we will no longer eat out and or eat grains or things that are cooked. And different people have different situations, but when you start getting serious in terms of sadhana, that affects the consciousness. And so when him and his wife just started eating basically what they cook for themselves, and for people who they, you know, It may not be the thing that you can rely on completely, but you should understand the effect. So this material situation of the demigods being fixed in goodness naturally, being sinless naturally, being free from distress, always happy, and that the food is they eat this soma ras, which it's not just material, it's just so that there's no disease and hunger or thirst. Of course, there's also the disadvantage that in that particular situation, you can think that I'm the enjoyer and I'm the controller and ruin everything. Even when I'm here at the Satsik Ashram and yesterday I bathed in the Kaveri, but, you know, I'm thinking, you know, so many things can disturb it. If I get a toothache, it's all ruined wherever I am. But to speak of old age and death, material environment, it's not the absolute thing, but certainly you can see. We can see the effects of it. And among the demigods, then they're going to point to Indra. They're going to point to Indra. Because Indra, he rules the world and he has these parijata, wish-fulfilling flowers, that one flower satisfies all one's desires. But his greatest fortune is that the Supreme Lord, Vamana, is his younger brother. And there's going to be a description of the superiority of this worship when you see the demigods worshiping the Supreme Lord. And it's quite spectacular because you have the siddhas, and they're offering these incredible prayers and worship. Because Narada goes and he sees Indra sitting on the throne. Before he even sees Indra, he sees Vamana sitting on the throne, and the siddhas are chanting prayers, the vidyadharas, they have musical instruments. Can you imagine? We all like musical instruments. But can you imagine what it's like to hear the musical instruments by the demigods? What that music is like? What to speak of the Gandharvas singing? Gandharvas singing, what does that mean? That means that whatever, the three tenors or the four tenors or Stevie Wonder or whoever it is, they're nothing. When you can hear the demigods singing, and there was previous in the courts of Akbar, there was these famous singers that became Vaishnavas. I think in the line of Nimbarka. You know, they're the ones that could crack the glass with their voice. And then the apsaras were dancing. So all the demigods, they're there. And there's elaborate worship by the 64 items of worship. And there's Indra with his thousand eyes. He's continuously shedding tears. So we're going to have another level of devotion. We're going to see devotion in another context. Devotion in a rarefied, purified form of goodness in association with the expansion of the Supreme Lord in the most ideal setting. So the king is going to say, I'm here on the earth, and you know how much difficult there is. See, I'm a human, I have short lifespan, little opulence, I have no independence, I'm constantly attacked by fear of other rulers, I'm in deep misery. And he so humbled the king that when he's praying, he said, I would not even deserve Krishna's word that in the future he might show me mercy. Very bhakta nami hum. I am not a devotee. It's just devotion is a hunger. So the more you have, the less you feel you have it. It's like food. The nature of food, the more you have it, the less you desire food. Bhakti is a desire for Krishna. But the more you have it, the more you hanker and hunger for Krishna. So the highest stage of devotion, there's so much desire for Krishna that you don't even think you have it. So this is very wonderful. We're seeing devotion in different contexts. So we'll go on to Indra. And I'm not now reading every verse. I'm going to pick out key verses and explain the stories and study them before. Of course, in this type of medium where I don't speak every day to the same audience that don't lead to the whole context of the thing, I'm afraid it will go a little slow. Okay, would anyone like to ask a question?
Maharaj?
How are you?
It's Mahamuni, physics at Mahamuni basis.
Great, Mahamuni. Hi, Krishna.
Thanks so much for your class, Maharaj.
Thank you.
My question is, you had mentioned that one sadhu that you had spoken to had mentioned that if the belly's not good, the head's not good. And
yeah.
the idea, as far as I understood, was that we should take seriously how we can live a life that can support our practice. And that our practice will improve if we take care of these things that we may not think are that important sometimes.
Well, it's not automatically help, obviously, but it's a factor, not the absolute factor, but a factor that can affect our concentration, obviously.
Okay. Yeah. So then I guess the question I have is, it just seems really clear that people's ability to perform bhakti yoga often depends a lot on their circumstances. And at the same time, we understand that bhakti does not depend on one's material circumstances. For example, I know people who, because of their karma, don't have to work much and they can live most of their life just traveling to Vrindavan, whereas other people might have to work 15 hours a day, and by the time they get home, their mind is very hard to concentrate on the holy name.
Right.
So it seems like the first person, their material circumstances have allowed them to associate with sadhus, to hear and chant and Vrindavan more. It seems like there's a lot that one's material circumstances have to play into one's ability to perform bhakti yoga. So
I'll put it this way, obviously we all have different karma, and Krishna has to purify us of various desires and give us various conceptions. And obviously you see that sometimes the devotees that are most ill are the most Krishna conscious because they don't have an enjoying spirit. I think we have to put everything in context. And sometimes the devotees like Kunti that are in the most distress, take the most shelter of Krishna. But it's not that the devotee who's in distress or the devotee that's sick is not trying to get healthy. You know, somehow it's a facility, but also whatever circumstance you have is tailored to bring you towards Krishna. And sometimes people are old and ill and they can't chant. You know, I'm looking at myself right now, you know. You know, I have a mixed karma, you know. Good health karma, terrible political karma, you know. But I'm looking in one sense, okay, now I'm feeling a little relaxed. You know, I wake up, I have all day, you know what I'm saying, to do what I want. But then I see danger. And I see the danger is I will not take my time seriously.
Right.
And what I fear is, because I'm not taking my time seriously, because I have all the time, then what will happen? In the future, Krishna will take that time away. Then my next life, I'll be the grihastha, right? Right? Overwhelmed with family and work and praying and developing the inner consciousness. If I ever get time to serve Krishna, you know, I will take that time so seriously. So it's a long continuum, and the person is free to go. And, you know, and freedom and that kind of life that you're describing, boy, is that dangerous. The devotee who doesn't have to work, the devotee who is all the time. We don't see that necessarily those are the devotees that are, you know, fully there in Krishna consciousness. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But they may become the enjoying spirit of the world. And the person who's kind of overwhelmed becomes humble. So I appreciate, I really like that you're listening in. Because, you know, in this kind of medium, I really don't want misconceptions. And we probably don't have time to clear it exactly. But I think we would put these things is that certainly we strive for a material situation that's conducive to Krishna consciousness. Certainly that's there. We realize that that situation is not absolutely Krishna conscious, and that situation may not even help us become Krishna conscious, because another situation may be better than us. And, you know, I've seen it too. You'll see that devotee who's at grihastha, and he's worked hard, and he's like hankering, when will that day be mine, where I have free time, and I can have, you know, and he'll cultivate such a serious, strong desire if he wants, even though he doesn't have the time, and he's separated from that time, he'll cultivate that desire so strong that when he becomes free from his material situation, he'll be better than any sannyasi, because he'll appreciate it so much. When something is rare, you tend to appreciate it more. I had a godbrother that was so much in management, he couldn't do the bhajan he wanted, and he was consulting with another godbrother who was senior, and that godbrother said something very nice, you know. By doing that seva to the guru, then you can get everything all at once. And I think because it cultivates an appreciation. Spiritual life is our gratitude and appreciation. If you have all the time in the world, you will not appreciate that Krishna has given you all the time in the world. But if you don't have that time, boy, you'll appreciate. And I always told this when I saw that I was staying in Vrindavan, I would see godbrothers that would come for 2 or 3 weeks, honestly, and get more in that 2 or 3 weeks than I would get in a year. And I someone gave me the example, if you put a stone in water, how much will it absorb? But if you put a pot in a piece of water, immediately you can keep that stone for 100 years, how much water will it absorb? You can keep that cotton for a moment, how much water will that cotton absorb? So, it, you know, there's a thing that Krishna does to us to make the heart open to appreciate spiritual life. But within that heart that's open to spiritual life, and wanting spiritual life, naturally you'll make your situation conducive by taking care of how you eat, what you do, etc. But if the heart is not appreciating Krishna consciousness, the material situation is useless for you. So maybe we can think humbly, boy, in my previous life, like Benugal Swami is now, you know, a little free there, I wasted it. So even though I had the situation, it didn't matter what I eat, my health and my yoga and my thing and by the bank of a river, because my heart was just so unappreciative So I would put it this way. The most important thing is the heart. But if you have the heart and the appreciation, then you'll try to adjust your situation, but not in a controlling way. You'll see what's your destiny. And I've seen so many sadhus that are, you know, so sick and so ill that a lot of times real sadhus have bad karma, too. Because, you know, they don't have any money, they're in a little hut. I mean, what if their Venus must be? Debilitated Venus, you know? That was a material situation. So, Mahavuni, this is a very... Thank you for that question. Anything else on this?
Well, I really like your point, Marge. It seemed to me that the two things you were stressing is, one is that you can't really judge the nuances of someone's karma, whether it's useful or not, until you really understand the particular thing they're working through. So we can't really, from a distance. And the other thing, which I really liked a lot, was that any circumstance is powerful for our transformation if we just take advantage of it. And yeah, I appreciate that. You reminded me about that Prabhupada said something to Hayagriva Prabhu that blew his mind, and he said, your spiritual life is already here. Your spiritual life is already here. And anyway, thank you. I appreciate how you made that.
Another important thing is you could see how subtle communication is, because every point is in a particular context, right?
Mm-hmm.
And unless that context is understood, the point could be misunderstood. So I like that you, Gail, whoever else is there, in hearing the class, you know, ask questions on particular points that are true, but perhaps the context in which they're true has to be elaborated more. I think that's very important. All right, thank you. Okay, I'm going to have to go in just a minute or two. I don't really have time for more questions because I have to do my puja now. It's in the morning. It's 8:30 here and because of the class. And then I'm going to go to see this temple. And I just have to say, you know, everyone has their karma. You know, I mean, you know, some person has a good relationship with his family and they're sick. Someone has a loving wife, and someone has a good relationship with their family, but they're sick. Someone has a bad relationship with their family, but they're healthy. Someone has opulence and wealth, but they're always worried about it, you know. Someone is very, very poor, but satisfied. I mean, it's interesting. I like to say Hare Krishna to the community. It's in the Bhagavatam in the 11th canto. It's the place of Sanatana Rupa. Their ancestors came here. Baladev Vidyabhushana. This is where he got Krishna consciousness. So it's quite a place. Anybody like to say Hare Krishna to Govinda Garden? And me?
Hare Krishna.
Who's that?
Prema Bhakti Mark.
Prema, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Very good. Thank you so much. Good. Hare Krishna to your family from the Bank of the Kaveri to Rasaraj, Rasaprayana, and Chiefs, Haribo. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Hare? Anybody else? Someone tried. Anybody else like to try? Okay. Sunday's class will be from the next place, which is called Milky on the Bank of the Ocean. I'm not sure the place I'm in. I just stay in my room, so it really doesn't matter if I'm New York or any place else, because that's what I do all day. And then we'll have classes from Udupi, and I understand the reception is better there. Okay, Vanchakopa Tirubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah.